session number 11294, reel 3.
Commander Shute, reel 3.
It was here that we first experienced attacks by kamikaze aircraft. The point about a kamikaze attack is that it's probably a very efficient form of attack, simply because the pilot stands a far better chance of doing some damage to his target than if he made a conventional attack. We had no damage at all to any of our ships from conventional attacks, but quite a number of ships were damaged during kamikaze attacks. The pilot of the aircraft simply aims his aircraft at the ship and crashes it into the ship together with his bomb. This type of attack was very successful against the American carriers because they had wooden flight decks with no armor plating. And consequently, the kamikaze aircraft, would very often go right through the deck into the middle of the ship and explode in there. Our carriers all had armored flight decks, and none of them was ever penetrated, although there was a fair amount of damage done to aircraft on the deck. On the whole, they did very little to restrict our operations, and whatever damage was done to our ships was usually cleared up in time for operating again within a few hours. Our first one in Victorious was on the 1st of April, April Fool's Day, and this was a lone aircraft which found the fleet and made an attack on Victorious. The skipper, Captain Michael Denny, managed to maneuver the ship so that the aircraft's dive, which the aircraft had intended to dive in line with the flight deck, obviously to give himself a better target, but the captain managed to swing the ship so that in fact the aircraft went across the flight deck, and he just clipped the flight deck and exploded in the water alongside. It did very little damage to the ship at all. The next one we had was on the 6th of April, and there were a number of them came at the fleet, and one of them, which had a go at Illustrious, clipped the ship's island with its wing and again went in over the side, but not a lot of damage done. Formidable was the one ship which did in fact have a fair amount of damage done on the flight deck, because she was caught twice with aircraft parked on the deck and a suicide bomber went straight down the deck, damaged a lot of aircraft. However, getting back to the sort of things we did during these flights over the islands, the Sakishima Gunto, we would very often take the Avenger bombers in, escort them in, and they would crater the runways. And we would then be having got them away from the airfields, because there was never any fighter opposition over the airfields. There was anti-aircraft fire, but never any fighter opposition over the airfield. We would then go off and do strafing runs on the airfields or on the harbour installations, and see what there was that we could break up. The we got the impression that they used to defuel some of the aircraft after they'd landed, because it wasn't very often that if you hit one, it burned. There was a fair amount of anti-aircraft fire, mostly small arms, from the ground, and we used to come back with a few holes in the aircraft occasionally. Some of their anti-aircraft fire was very small caliber. It was smaller than a 303, and you'd finish up with a few sort of pepper holes in you. The CAPs over the fleet had more to do with the enemy aircraft than the aircraft over the target areas, because occasionally they would send out aircraft, and as I've said, we had these kamikaze attacks. Perhaps the next big one we had was on the 4th of May. When Indom was one of the targets, and again, it's an aircraft that bounced off her deck into the sea, but this is one of the days when Formidable had quite a large range of aircraft on a flight deck and lost everything that was on the flight deck. On the next attack we had on Vic was on the 9th of May, and again there were several suicide attacks early in the evening. Formidable was hit again, and the one that hit us hit the flight deck and skidded up the flight deck, and the bomb exploded just after he came off the heavily armoured area of the flight deck and exploded near the B turret, which is the port side turret forward, and blew a hole in the deck and killed people who were actually in the gun turrets. These were anti-aircraft gun turrets. Not anti-aircraft gun turrets. They were large caliber gun turrets. The damage done was such that they had to simply cut away the metal, and then they filled it in with rapid setting cement. And in fact, the ship was really never out of commission.
So they had all this in readiness in anticipation of kamikaze attack.
The damage control teams in the ship had everything ready, yes. And the, as I say, Formidable, again, lost the whole of her flight deck during that attack. But we never lost the use of the ships. They might have been out of use for an hour or two, and we occasionally had to accept aircraft from other ships or land in another ship if your ship wasn't ready to take you. But they were never taken out of commission, whereas the Americans, with their wooden flight decks, they had a very bad time. They actually lost ships completely through these attacks. It seems an odd thing to say, but it really was a very successful method, rather perhaps a bloodthirsty method of making attack, because you knew you were going to lose your life. But as far as that was concerned, none of the aircraft that made a conventional attacks on the big fleets off Japan ever got away. So at least they got something, the Japanese pilots got something out of it.
Did you ever hear of a Japanese pilot surviving a kamikaze attack?
No, they let's face it, they stayed in the aircraft while it hit its target. There wasn't a question of pointing the aircraft and jumping out. They actually stayed in the aircraft.
What was your attitude towards the Japanese enemy in the air? because I've interviewed people who fought on the ground in Burma, and there seems to have been a great deal of hatred for the Japanese. Did you feel that yourself as a pilot against pilot?
Well, I wouldn't say so, because you didn't actually, you weren't in personal contact with the pilot. I mean, you were fighting his aircraft as much as anything. I suppose while you were strafing on the airfields, maybe that was a little more personal, and you were getting shot at by the people on the ground. That became a little more personal then. But aircraft to aircraft, I wouldn't say that there was, you know, any great degree of hatred, because we hadn't been involved in any of the atrocities that you heard about with the Japanese soldiers, the ground forces.
What was your attitude towards the kamikaze pilots?
Well,
was it one of respect or contempt or what?
Well, I don't know that I thought very much about it. I don't suppose there was much respect for them, but when, as I say, when you thought about it, it was an effective form of attack, although I suppose it must have been a very great sense of patriotism which brought them to volunteer to do these things. Certainly they were going to lose their lives anyhow if they came near the fleet, and they achieved something in doing that. Well, one of the flights we did during this period was over northern Formosa, a break in the main iceberg series, and this was basically a fighter sweep over northern Formosa. It was a question really of finding targets and strafing them, with no particular targets laid on, but the idea was to let the Japanese know that we were around, and they hopefully prevent them using it again as a staging post. Well, later on in the month, on the 16th of May, I was sent over the islands, escorting the Avengers. I was by now senior pilot of the squadron, incidentally, and so in this particular flight I was acting as the group leader. And having taken the Avengers in, and they'd done their bombing, we set about strafing targets, and in this particular case we found some barges and store huts and managed to set things on fire. We then found five or six lorries on the ground, which we set about, and during an attack on the lorries, my number two called me up and said that there was smoke coming from my aircraft. Well, I looked at the oil pressure gauge and discovered that, in fact, it had gone right down to zero. So I knew then that I'd been hit in the oil coolers and was losing all my lubricating oil, which meant, of course, the aircraft wasn't going to stay in the air very long. So I turned out towards sea and got ready to ditch. My number two, of course, knew what was going on. He stayed with me and watched what was going on. Well, getting ready to ditch meant that by the time I hit the water, in fact, the engine had seized completely. So it's a question of leaving the flaps up, getting rid of the drop tank, leaving the undercarriage up, getting rid of the drop tank, and turning into wind and doing a dead stick glide landing onto the water. And I went in, well, about a mile and a half off the southeast tip of the island. Well, the aircraft is quite a big one, but it's clean underneath, so that it ditches quite well. It will skim along the water for a little while and then pitches up on its nose and stays afloat for long enough. So I was able to get out of the aircraft and got my dinghy out, the dinghy you sit on as part of your parachute pack, and inflated it, got into the dinghy and cut off the shrouds of the parachute, because the harness wasn't going to be much use to me, but the parachute might have been, because it was a yellow parachute and could be used to show somebody where I was. The yellow would throw up.
Cut it off with what?
Well, with a knife. On your Mae West, you carry a knife. There's a knife in your dinghy pack as well for doing such things as cutting parachute shrouds. But the aircraft sank, and of course I was then sitting in my dinghy, single seat dinghy, personal dinghy, in the water. I tied everything in and kept myself fastened into the dinghy. And my number two, a lad called Rod White, who was a New Zealander, had seen me go into the water and had climbed up above me and reported what had happened to me, reported back to the fleet. And we had air sea rescue submarines operating in the area. They were American submarines which were tasked to operate near the islands whenever a flying was going on, and it was their task to pick up pilots who survived their ditchings. Well, in this particular case, it was the last flight of the day, and it was beginning to get quite dark by the time everything was settled down. And I was just left alone with a few seabirds around me. And the aircraft who had been looking out for me had had to go back to the fleet by then. But, I mean, I learned later, obviously, that they had managed to get through and had passed a message about my position.
Were you in full view of the island?
No, I couldn't see the island. The islands had... There was no height to them. Consequently, the horizon... could be fairly close, but you still wouldn't see the island. And I'd been in the water in the dinghy for about 2 hours when I saw what I thought was a boat some distance away. Unfortunately, I couldn't make out whether it was a submarine or whether it was a Japanese boat coming after me, so I didn't do anything initially. And after about 5 or 10 minutes, I could see from the shape of it that, in fact, it was the submarine. So I fired off a distress flare, which, again, you carry distress flares in your Mae West. Fired off a distress flare, and we also had waterproof torches, which I was able to use, wave about the air, for him to home himself on me. And it was actually pitch black by the time I was picked up by the submarine. Taken on board. And of course, being an American ship, the only grog they had on board was in the medicine chest, so some brandy came out of the medicine chest. And I was fed that and given a hot shower and a nice meal, and then they started asking questions about, you know, where I'd be, what had happened and all the rest of it. Well, it turned out that this was the USS Bluefish. And she already had the crew of one of Indomitable's Avengers on board and the crew of an American Avenger. And so there we are. I was picked up and safe.
What condition were you in when you were rescued?
Just wet, that's all.
And cold?
Not particularly cold. This was May in tropical waters. So I wasn't cold.
Any dangerous fish you had any interest in?
No, nothing at all. Even the birds left me when it got dark.
Well, was your presumption that if there was a submarine there, it wouldn't be Japanese?
Well, yes, insofar as no Japanese submarines had been sighted. The Japanese fleet by this time was in a pretty poor state. It would be unlikely that they would put a submarine in an area like that simply in order to pick up air crew to interrogate them or whatever. They could get air crew from having shot them down over the islands. I mean, quite a lot of air crew were shot down and captured over the islands, and they were interrogated. But they wouldn't waste a submarine on that. If there was going to be a submarine around, it would be out amongst the fleet. But let's face it, the anti-submarine work in the fleet was such that they wouldn't have got into the middle of the fleet with a submarine. So there wasn't any problem as far as that was concerned.
Had you been told that if you ditched, there would be
submarines? Oh, yes, we knew these submarines were around. But, I mean, you could never be quite sure whether they would be in the right place at the right time or whether any distress message would reach them. And they didn't search for people unless they were given a position. I mean, you can't expect them to just patrol around looking for aircraft ditching. They didn't actually see me go in. So here we were in an American submarine. And while I was aboard there, they had, in fact, what turned out to be their second birthday, the ship's second birthday in the USS Bluefish. And to celebrate this, we had a turkey dinner with strawberries and ice cream, of course. And they went close inshore and used their deck gun to bombard the island by way of a firework display. We were down below, of course. It was only the gunnery crew who were on deck. But the thing I remember about that was sitting down below and you'd hear the gun go off, thump, and then the next thing you were waiting for was the empty cartridge case to clatter down onto the casing of the submarine. And as it was hand-loaded, there were always varying intervals between the firing of the gun and the shell case dropping on the floor. And so we were all beginning to count how many there were going. Anyhow, it was a 5-inch gun, so it was quite a clang. That was on the 16th of May. And it was the 28th of May before she was due to end her patrol off the island. And that evening we set off for Subic Bay in the Manilas, in the Philippines, Subic Bay, Luzon. We arrived there on the 1st of June. And what amused us was that the first people on board the submarine were some American ratings carrying fresh ice cream for the boys. So here I was in the Philippines, and I didn't know where Victorious was by then. But actually, it was coming near the end of the operation. In fact, she was on her way back to Sydney by now. So there was no chance of me getting back to her. We had asked the submarine captain whether he could raise the fleet and ask if we could be picked up by a destroyer, but either he didn't get through or they couldn't agree to sending a destroyer in to pick us up and return us direct to the fleet. So in fact, I virtually hitchhiked from the Philippines back down to Sydney on various aircraft. After a while, in New Guinea, I joined up with the RAF where things were a little more organised. But up till then, it really was a question of going along and saying, look, here are my papers. The commanding officer of USS Bluefish, who was a lieutenant commander, junior grade, Forbes, had in fact given me a discharge paper which read, you were rescued at sea on May the 16th, 1945, after plane crash due to enemy action near Sakashima Gunto. You served aboard the USS Bluefish during her 8th war patrol from May the 16th, 1945 to June 1, 1945. Upon return to base, you are detached from all duties on board this vessel and will proceed in accordance with orders from proper authority. Well, the proper authority, in effect, said, well, you need to get back to your ship. So, really, that's what I did. And got back via RAF Transport Command, eventually, down to Sydney, where I found Victorious in Sydney Harbour and was granted a couple of days' leave.
Survivors, eh?
In effect, I suppose, yes. But by now, the squadron composition had changed very considerably. We had we were up off the Sakashima Gunto, the very first flight we did in Operation Iceberg, we lost our CO, Chris Tomkinson, and the then senior pilot, Edmondson, became the CO, and as he moved up, I moved up into his job as senior pilot. And after I was shot down, Edmondson was lost, so they finished up with a sub-lieutenant, a New Zealand sub-lieutenant, Dusty Rhodes, as the senior man in the squadron. Well, he was temporarily promoted a lieutenant. When I got back to Sydney, it was to discover that everybody in the squadron had either been sent home on leave or sent off to other jobs, except Dusty and myself. And we went out to Schofield, which was an airfield near Sydney, and on the 16th of June we met our new CO, who was a New Zealander, Dennis Evans. The squadron was now, there were 24 pilots by now, so we had quite a lot of new faces, and we spent time at Schofields working up the new squadron. And during that time, Dusty and I went down to Melbourne to see a demonstration of what they called at that time blaze bombing. Well, in fact, this is what later became known as napalm bombing. And as far as the Corsair was concerned, it consisted of filling the drop tank. We had a 135-gallon drop tank, which we always carried. This is what gave us such exceptional range. Slung between the wheels, underneath the belly of the aircraft. And this would be filled with a mixture of petrol and a jelly, so that in fact it became fairly solid. And then in the filler cap would go a grenade,